Welcome to this audio recording by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to promoting public awareness of global issues and the ways in which they affect the Dallas-Fort Worth region. Become a member today at dfwworld.org and help us connect North Texas with the world. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
And I'd like to thank our speaker, Dr. Rathjen, for joining us. We're really excited when Pat Patterson, our immediate past chairman, suggested this program, and really proud to have a Dallasite that was so involved in the relief efforts right at the beginning of the, one of the biggest humanitarian disasters we've seen in this hemisphere in decades. We're also really grateful to the Warwick Melrose for their sponsorship of today's event. They underwrite the entire Saturday at the Warwick Melrose series and have given us the space several times a year for years now. So we're very grateful to them. And I'd also like to very much thank Lucy Billingsley, who's the sponsor of our Global Connection series. She was the starter, the founder of that series, and has continued to support it at a major level every year. So we're very grateful to her and also miss her this morning.
Thank you very much, Pat. Well, that is, I always say I would like nothing better than to be introduced as Henry and Betty's dad. So, and I had never told Pat that, so that's a great compliment, and I'm very grateful. It's really a privilege for me to be here, and I want to thank Jim and Jessica and the whole Council for World Affairs for sponsoring this and for inviting me to be here, and really for all you do and all the supporters of the council do to both make Dallas aware of the world and to make the world aware of Dallas. Whether it's studying the threats of cyber attacks, which you helped organize last fall, and all the other tremendous things that you do, I think make our community a better place for it. And so it's a fun opportunity this morning for me to share a little with you what I experienced in Haiti and the little bit that I know about Haiti. I'm a children's orthopedic surgeon, which is pretty rare. There's about 800 of us in North America. My practice is, clinical practice is predominantly at Scottish Rite and Children's, and we serve as part of the pediatric or as part of the orthopedic department at UT Southwestern. Let me start with my slides and we'll kind of work things through. Tuesday, January 12th, was a magnitude 7.3 quake. About the epicenter was between 10 and 16 miles from Port-au-Prince. And on Thursday, January 14th, so almost 48 hours after the earthquake, my friend and colleague, Scott Nelson, was on the ground in Port-au-Prince. Scott is also a pediatric orthopedic surgeon. He, for 5 years, has run a faith-based hospital in the Dominican Republic for an organization called Cure International. And his pediatrician is Haitian. And he, for 5 years, he has spent 1 week every 3 months, so 1 week a quarter, at a border town, spending a week seeing patients from Haiti and operating on them. He keeps what could best be described as a small dumpster full of orthopedics, orthopedic tools. And for those of you who have the good fortune of never having been the patient of an orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Urschel and my father would tell you that it's really nothing more than glorified carpentry. We have lots of power tools, we have screws, we have saws, and it's in many ways it's pretty, but to do what we do requires those tools and those instruments. And so Scott realized that he was uniquely positioned to go and help, because with an earthquake you have a lot of crush injuries, and with that you have a lot of orthopedic trauma. And he had essentially could supply an operating room with this dumpster already across the border. And he said, if I can get myself to Port-au-Prince, I can send somebody from Port-au-Prince over land to get my equipment. So before the airport was open, he chartered a plane, landed on the closed airport, had a friend of his pediatrician meet him at the airport, and took him to six hospitals in Port-au-Prince. He selected the one that had electricity, running water, and something that could resemble a sterile operating room. And he kind of staked his flag. And he sent somebody over land to go get his dumpster full of drills and screws and plates and rods and orthopedic stuff. And he went to work. So we heard about that. Thursday night, I got an email from Cure International, just not to me specifically, but kind of a blanket email that he was there. And I kind of responded to him. And so Friday morning, when Carolyn, my wife, found it, she said, "You have to offer to go." So these are the two people who made me being here today really possible. And so the next 4.5 days were kind of a whirlwind. And for me, that part, there's no pictures of that. But from Friday afternoon until noon on Wednesday, working with Cure International and their home office in Pennsylvania and their development director here in Dallas, and friends and colleagues, and 4.5 days, we organized. So we had patients, we had a hospital, and we had orthopedic tools. So what Scott said, he said, "I need a couple of surgeons, and I need anesthesiologists, and I need nurses, and I need drugs." And so that's for 4.5 days, we tried to organize those things. And we ended up with a 737 that had about 4 tons of equipment and 25 people on it. And there's really no way to describe what that 4.5 days was like for me personally. The people would offer me things that before I could, you know, respond via email with a BlackBerry, I'd think, "Well, no thanks, I don't need that." And then 30 minutes later, you know, we'd get an email from somebody on the ground that this is exactly what you need. One of our anesthesiologists, there's an anesthesiologist who's going to come from Boston on Tuesday morning. He backed out. Before I could kind of process that in the context of my normal Tuesday day, I sent an email out Tuesday night at about 6 p.m. to a handful of anesthesiologists that I knew in Dallas. Wednesday morning at 6 a.m., DeWitt McCarter emailed back and said, "I'll go." We left at midnight Wednesday night. He had, you know, 18 hours to kind of get ready and process it. And he was there and he, you know, worked nonstop when he was there. So, and I could, you know, talk for the rest of the day probably about stories of that. I mean, just these that weren't really coincidences, but just how the hand of fate really orchestrated this trip. This kind of redhead fellow in the black hat is a real estate developer in South Florida. I knew none of this at the time. In fact, I was in Haiti for 5 days before I think I even knew his name. And we've subsequently become friends. He's a successful real estate developer in South Florida because he hasn't done a deal since 2005. And he's also a friend of Scott Nelson's. And he heard that Scott was in Port-au-Prince, and he just went. And he got there about 3 days before we did. And as he said, "The only time I've ever been in an operating room, I've been on my back." But he was kind of our key logistical grip. And he was the person on the ground who would talk to Scott and talk to the doctors and talk to the nurses. And then he would send emails and text to the Cure home office, who would then send it on to us. And then we spent these kind of 4.5 crazy days of organizing things. The young man in the middle is the driver when Scott landed in Port-au-Prince. And then the woman to the right is his mother, who this family, there is a mother and 2 daughters and a son, and they were in the hospital every morning before 9 a.m., and they left every evening after 9 p.m. They were local Haitians that were really using their affluence and their influence to staff and run this hospital and to help all these, you know, non-government organizations that were interested and come help the people of their community. And so this is the Haitian Community Hospital, or ACH, which was our destination after we landed. And the, logistically, to me, the hardest thing was once we got everything on the plane was we were going to have, you know, 8,000 pounds of equipment in a country that wasn't really known for its infrastructure before this earthquake. And I thought, how, I mean, the apprehension to me was once we land on the ground, how are we going to get these people and this equipment to this hospital? And Jeff had organized that, and we had trucks. You can see the school bus, which was one of the ways. And just on the other side of that jet was a big military transport jet. So the juxtaposition of, you know, the military personnel and the things that were there with just the tap-taps and the school buses, and you just used whatever was there that could somehow meet your needs. Before the quake, maybe all of y'all know this, the population of Haiti was about 9 million, and a third of those people lived in Port-au-Prince. 40% of the population is under 14 years of age. 50% of the Haitian people are illiterate. 76% live on less than $2 a day. And it's recognized as the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. And the describing the political chaos in Haiti in the last 50 years is beyond, you know, obviously my expertise. And I think when you really, when you go to the answer, and at the end of the slide we'll talk about what next, and obviously that's part of it. I mean, without the rule of law and a stable government, it's going to be very hard to move the needle there. One of the interesting things, one of the 25 people on our trip was a pediatric infectious disease doctor from New York who is married to a Haitian. And he, we, Carol and I were having dinner with him before we, Wednesday night before we got on the plane to go. And it, we said, give us a 10-minute synopsis of, you know, What's the story of Haiti? Why is it so dysfunctional? And he said, the more that I know, the less I understand. And I think, you know, that certainly has been my experience, to try to put my arms around the history of the, you know, political instability and problems there. It's certainly difficult. If you look at healthcare in Haiti, the average life expectancy is 55 compared to 78 in the United States. 117 children out of every 1,000 will die in the first 5 years of life, which is 15 times the incidence in the United States. And this was shocking to me. 680 out of every 100,000 mothers die in childbirth. 50 times the rate of what it happens here. I mean, your death in childbirth, we think, it doesn't happen in this country, hardly. But yet it's still very much a part of everyday life in Haiti. And if you kind of look at orthopedic stuff, you know, orthopedic surgeons are very, you know, egocentric, so it's really all about orthopedics, right? You know, so we'll talk about orthopedics. So there were 11 hospitals in Port-au-Prince before the quake and 10 in the rest of the country, so 21 hospitals for a population of 9 million, which is a little bit greater than our Metroplex area, right? And you can probably hit 21 hospitals in a 10-mile radius of the Melrose. C-arms, which is the live fluoroscopy. So one of the things we do in orthopedics is we don't have to just take an x-ray like you go in for a chest x-ray. We have a movie camera x-ray, this big tube, and you push a button and you can see what you're doing live. And it's become, in modern orthopedic surgery, it's almost part of what we do. And certainly in managing trauma and fracture, it's kind of the standard of care. In Port-au-Prince before the quake, there were 3 and none in the rest of the country. At Scottish Rite, this little, just a pediatric orthopedic hospital, we have 4 operating rooms and 3 C-arms. And there's 3 in the entire, you know, country. In 2009, there were 46 orthopedic surgeons who did 2,000 operations. Again, at Scottish Rite, we have 9 surgeons and we do about 2,000 a year. So it just gives you some idea of the lack of care that was there before the quake. When we landed, what we learned kind of later that first day was it was the first day, so we got there on Thursday, 9 days after the earthquake. And it was the first day that they said people were out in the streets. And so, you know, obviously we had no knowledge of what to expect, and you had heard about, you know, just the stench and the dust. And to me this looked In many ways, you know, it's like, well, I mean, you could see the devastated areas where the houses had completely collapsed, but again, knowing how desperate this country was beforehand, in some ways, to me, this looked surprisingly good on the way to the airport. When we got to the hospital, it's a 75-bed hospital, and they estimated that there are between 250 and 300 patients in the hospital. And so this is how. I mean, they just, you know, any bedroll sheet, people are just on the ground. One of the things that didn't even occur to me, you know, when you have surgery, they won't let you have anything to eat or drink for 8 hours before the anesthetic. And that's a big part of when, you know, surgeons, we make sure that they don't do it so you can do the surgery when you want to and you don't have to be delayed. It didn't dawn on me for the first 3 days that we never had to worry about not anybody not having anything to eat or drink, because there was so little there to eat or drink. Really, none of the there was no food service in the hospital. None of the patients really had anything to eat or drink. We unpacked and we unloaded. This is the patients who weren't in the hospital or who had been outside the hospital were in the streets around the hospital. So this is a patient, the sign says he has a thoracic spine fracture. Patients would take their IV bottles, and the woman here lying on a pallet on the ground, and, you know, has got her leg wrapped in a splint. And just very, very, very calm. Even when we showed up with four truckloads worth of equipment, you know, just calm. You know, lots of people just showing up to help you unload it. Now, it turns out, again, later you realize some of that stuff was unloaded and carried upstairs and then taken over the back wall and out, you know. But there's just, you know, from everything that we saw, there was a real sense of calm, which I think makes you realize how little this culture is used to having, you know, that they can have the devastation of this magnitude, and it just kind of almost accepted. This is, you know, the tent city. This is the road that lines the hospital. And we're in North Port-au-Prince in a suburb called Pétionville. And you can see there's a Hospital Day Haitian community is this yellow sign, and they've turned it into a place to dry clothes. And every little space was a homemade tent that had sprung up in just 9 days. So after we unpacked our stuff, we went to work. And orthopedic surgeons fix broken bones. These are thigh bones or femur fractures. And you would think this looks pretty much like any operating room. And in reality, it was. There were so very many similar things, but then some things were so kind of surreally different. The woman in this middle picture on the far left is one of our scrub nurses from Scottish Rite. And I remember very distinctly telling her the second or third night, and it was about 2 a.m, and we were kind of closing the wound, and, you know, there was one light that you could barely see with, and, you know, none of the, like, suction and cautery and these things that we kind of take for, and I was using a little, you know, forceps to do it without any, just one hand kind of sewing, and I looked at her and I said, Shara, I said, if you tell anybody that I did this without light and suction and cautery and using this as a stitch, I said, not only will I deny it, I said, I will send you back here. But that was just, you know, everybody pitched in and worked. And one of the things that's not really normal about this photograph is that the scrub nurse in the back, in the middle of the bottom picture, is actually a Presbyterian minister who came along to help. And when he got there, I mean, I kind of envisioned him as being the chaplain in the hospital. But when he got there, he realized, you know, that it was the team of surgeons and nurses that needed the most help. And so here's a minister who doesn't really like the sight of blood who becomes a circulating nurse in, you know, in very short order. There are some things that were different. These were our accommodations. People have asked about that. We slept in tents or cots on the roof of the hospital. The view at times could be spectacular. The dogs bark until about 2 a.m, and the roosters start crowing at about 4:30. So you might as well work until 2 and get up and start early again the next morning. We had some MREs along, which were most of the sustenance. Water was never an issue. There's bottled water delivered every day from the various relief organizations. We were wondering what the status of potable water would be. And then the one thing that is interesting, the MREs would disappear. I mean, the Haitians would, they just kind of, there were never MREs, you know, and so this was the one area where the volunteers and some of the stuff was squirreled away. The Pop-Tarts, somebody sent Pop-Tarts. And for some reason, the Pop-Tarts never went away. You could always have a Pop-Tart if you wanted one. I don't know the significance of that. So, so there are some other things that were different. This little boy holding the pocket cross from the Presbyterian minister has a piece of tape on his head that says, it basically is his orders. That's how we didn't necessarily early in the first two or three days, we didn't have paperwork, and you had people speaking English and French and Creole and Swedish. And so we would, you know, put tape on the patients, and we would put a piece of tape on their bandage and give the instructions to the next person as when to the dressings were to be changed. The drills, orthopedic surgeons use drills, you know, a sterile drill requires, you know, an autoclave to sterilize it, and, you know, probably costs $2,000 because it's a piece of medical equipment. Scott Nelson, my friend and colleague who's worked in the Dominican Republic, had figured out that you could just take a $20 power drill and put a little sterile bag around it. I mean, the problem is here we didn't even have sterile bags. And somebody had sent large, like size 9 gloves, which almost nobody has a size 9 hand. And they didn't work for much, but you could put 2 gloves around the drill, and they're disposable sterile gloves, and you could make the drill sterile. So you could keep using it, because otherwise we had no real way to use it. And then this is, you know, kind of reminds me of the old TV series MASH. This is how you get the patients in and out of the operating room, is a gurney that the two surgeons carry in and out. And this gentleman, I mean, in the It's a Small World and in the Hand of Providence, this is Brad White, who's an orthopedic surgeon in New Hampshire. He saw my name tag the first day, and he said, "Carl Rathjen." He goes, "Are you any relation to Kurt?" And Kurt is my brother, who's also an orthopedic surgeon. And I said, "Well, I'm his younger brother." And he goes, "Oh, I was in his medical school class." And so Brad rolled into our group and became an integral part of what we were doing. You can see up here that we don't really have view boxes, so the x-rays are hung on the fluorescent lights. That's not exactly the way we do things. This is the central supply room. So when you need something, you have to, and there were, you know, 2 or 3 people, you know, basically 16 hours a day trying to keep this stuff sorted out so you could find it and use it. And here are 2 of our anesthesiologists who are transporting 2 patients in an ambulance, the back of a van, to a helicopter pad so we could get them on the Mercy ship, because they were too sick. We didn't have the resources to keep them alive at the hospital we were at. And that's probably the thing that was most different, is that in orthopedic surgery, we don't deal with death very often. We had a patient die every day that I was there in the hospital. We had 2 patients die on the operating room table. I mean, I haven't seen that happen since I was an intern taking care of gunshot victims at Parkland. We had 3 patients die of tetanus. Because none of the North American doctors, I mean, everybody was, you know, getting out the book or getting out their iPhone app and you know, Googling tetanus, because we never seen it. We didn't know how to treat it. So there were some tremendously different things. But as a surgeon, as I kind of reflect on my experience compared to many of my colleagues who are pediatricians or emergency room docs, there is a sense of you go into the operating room and you have one problem to fix and you do it differently, but the end result is the same, and you put a dressing on the patient and you carry them out of the operating room, and there is a real sense of closure and accomplishment that comes with that, you know, 10 times in a day, that I think was a very different experience than people who were just constantly in the chaos trying to, you know, and every morning it would be, you would go out and you kind of have things lined up from the night before, and the patients would have left and gone and moved. And so it was very interesting, this kind of culture of you couldn't organize it. I mean, it was just always entropy. It was always, you know, dispersing itself back out, and you'd try to get it together, and then it would kind of go back again. And my sense from what I've learned and the people I've talked to is that is almost a cultural phenomenon. And I think it may be a challenge moving forward. And, you know, so this is the presidential palace before. And this is the presidential palace, the picture that one of our anesthesiologists took on the way to take the patients to the helicopter to get them on the Mercy ship. Just literally flattened in pancakes. So, you know, clearly things are different. And what do we do? Probably 220,000 dead, twice as deadly as any other 7.0 Richter scale. If you remember at the end of January, there's an 8.0 earthquake in Chile, and they had less than 1,000 people dead. I mean, you didn't hear about it because there's more infrastructure, there's more political stability, there's better building codes. They actually put rebar in their concrete. There were 300,000 injured, 80% of those who survived. So, you know, chest injuries like Dr. Urschel takes care of, head injuries like the neurosurgeons take care of, generally don't survive. Even the spine fractures, the upper extremity fractures are less. You get your arms out of the way when a building's falling on you. So the survivors who were injured, the vast majority of them have pelvis and lower extremity injuries, which is, I think, why this has been such a, for the orthopedic community and for our national orthopedic organizations, this has been a real, there's been a tremendous outpouring of effort and interest in addressing this. The Haitian population was 9 million before. Is 8.6 million today from dead and from those who have fled and immigrated. The population of Port-au-Prince is down from 3 million to 2.2 million. 1.5 million people are displaced. And what was 21 hospitals and 3 C arms is now 6 hospitals and 3 C arms. So what tomorrow, and this I guess is kind of my next to the last closing comments is, you know, the hurricane season we're right in the middle of. With that come the floods, which, you know, in 2008 there were devastating floods which caused disease and death that were a tremendous problem. Elections this November, one of the things that I've been reading is that I'm not really familiar with the rapper Wyclef Jean, but he is of Haitian origin and thought that he could run for president. And I saw last night that that the electoral vetting process has said that he's not eligible to run. And I think that this was actually, they were worried that because he has such name recognition that this completely unqualified rapper could actually, you know, be elected president. So I think that that's a good thing. You know, as we within our the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons and the Pediatric Orthopedic Society of North America kind of work at how can we help, the nursing schools were crushed. 80% of the nursing students were crushed. You know, so the nurses that work in the hospitals are displaced. I mean, that there wasn't much infrastructure there, and the infrastructure that was there is gone. And so it's for me, it's almost mind-boggling. It's a lot easier to go in the operating room and take care of one problem, because it's really hard to look at how do you move on from here. And one of the things that that we as orthopedic surgeons who've been there or who are interested in the problem is that, you know, free medical care, all of these North American, you know, medical teams that show up to give free medical care are crippling the recovery of their normal healthcare industry. And so there's a real sense of, you know, how do we, what's the system going forward of, you know, how can we partner with the Haitians that are there so they can deliver more care and they can deliver it at a cost that people can afford, but yet these people can still earn a living, because otherwise you're really taking away the job of the local Haitian orthopedist. And so to try to set up very structured credential programs where the North American healthcare teams that go over are actually working in tandem with and giving some financial support back to the people whose work that they're doing. So because there's a humanitarian need to care for the patients, but at the same token, if you just keep giving them fish, they're never going to be able to do it themselves. So it'd be very interesting to see how it transpires. This is what I'll leave with. It'll probably be hard for me to tell the story. I apologize. I think that smile says it all. This little girl is very poignant. This is on the day we left after 6 days, and there's a sense of hope, despite the obvious, tragedy. Her mother, her father, this is one of the first operations that we did when we were there, and her father was there, and we talked to him before the surgery. So we'll do everything we can, but if the infection is too severe, she may lose her foot. And so we came out and told them there was nothing we can do, and she lost her foot. And that night, late that night, at 2 in the morning, I heard this just wailing. And the hospital was so quiet at night, despite the suffering of these people. And I heard this, I take care of kids, that's all I do. And so I can hear a mother's wail. I knew exactly what it was, and I suspected who it was. And sure enough, it was this girl's mother. So I searched around and woke up another patient who spoke English and got him to translate for me and tried to explain to her, as I would in my practice at Children's, at the Level 1 Trauma Center, a child who loses her foot in 3 months will be playing sports. And, with all due respect of, somebody who has 10 toes, just losing your foot with today's technology is not much of a disability. And so on a much simpler scale, I was explaining to the mother that really what made her beautiful was her mind and her smile and not her 10 toes. And that we were going to have her run and jump and play and do things. And the mother asked a question in Creole that I didn't need a translator for, because it was three sentences, it was three words, and the last word was prosthesis. And she said, "Where will she get a prosthesis?" And that's kind of haunted me, because that's the recovery. There's 2,000 to 4,000 amputees in a country that probably doesn't have very good prosthetic care. And so that's one of the things that I've tried to spend some of my effort on, since I've been back, is how can we, continue to keep the smiles on these beautiful people. And they are just the most gracious, lovely people. And we really, had a wonderful time. So I probably talked too long. Thanks.
We'll open it up for questions, but before I do, I just wanted to thank you so much for going in. Mrs. Ralston, I can't imagine being so willing to send your husband into a disaster zone. So thank you also. It's amazing what you both did. And with that, we'll open it up for questions. I'm sure there are plenty.
So the question was, even in the U.S. during Katrina, we didn't have very good established command protocols. And now in a society with really chaos to start with, what was it like when you throw this on? And did we experience any of that politicking or chaos? And yes and no. Interestingly, they were even, because you had all of these NGOs. So the response, to, I think, an international disaster like this in the first wave is government and then also a lot of NGOs. Interestingly, I have some colleagues in Israel, and the Israeli Defense Force had a hospital up and running Saturday at noon. The earthquake was Tuesday at 2. The USS, I think it's either the Hope or the Mercy, I can't remember which one they had in the harbor. We got there on Thursday, and I think the Hope and Mercy, so we got there 5 days after the Israelis, and the first really organized field hospital from the U.S. government was 2 or 3 days after that. So the Israelis, loaded up a 747 and were on the ground running, and they left. As soon as the U.S. Navy hospital was there, they pulled out and left because they had more resources. So the UN had driving around, you would see, UN trucks and soldiers and razor wire. They had a meeting for all the hospital administrators every day at 4 o'clock. And so we kind of heard what was going on about that. It was more than anything else, it was just chaos. You take the Salvation Army, a generator, and then you couldn't get a hold of them. There was no coordination between inner agencies, between what do you have and what do we need. And people literally, as Jeff, the real estate developer from South Florida, told us in the bus on the way to the hospital, he said, if you see something that needs to be done, just do it. He said, don't ask for permission, because there's nobody who has the authority to give permission. And so hospitals did have some communication that, as best as I could entertain, was really just the local NGO, you know, that had the dominant force would then kind of figure out where the other hospitals were, and they would drive to that hospital. There wasn't a good way to call with, I mean, text service was very good, but I don't think they knew who was in charge. And then interestingly, even within, you know, we had Team Sweden and we had the CURE team, and then we had a team of New York plastic surgeons that came in. And, you know, at times there was even, you know, fights over patients between these, you know, three groups of people. I mean, it just makes you realize that when there's no rules and when people are, you know, well-intended and very emotional and exhausted, both physically and emotionally, you know, you'd kind of see behavior that was interesting, to say the least. So, yeah, I mean, there was both on a local, just, you know, colleagues fighting over who's going to care for which patient, and then on a grander scale, you know, within our hospital, there was who's going to be in charge of this, who's going to be here for a month, who's going to be in here for a week. And I'm sure, I left the hospital one night for about 12 hours, so I was very much in a cocoon the whole time. But I suspect at each level of infrastructure as you went up, there was this kind of chaos of who can assert control. My suspicion is that probably still exists.
I was wondering if you found yourself doing any medical work outside of your specialty, such as delivering babies or removing appendixes or something like that.
So the question was, did we do any medical work outside of our specialty? And thankfully, no. And that was, you know, one of my concerns in those 4 days before we left is I said, you know, I know I have a trusted friend and colleague on the ground, and he knows that he can use my unique skill set. You know, and I talked to the people at CURE, and I said, when if we don't have anesthesiologists, we don't have nurses, we don't have drugs, or we run out of orthopedic equipment, I said, I should leave. I said, because there's not that much water and there's not that much food, and there's people that are better trained at removing rubble and counseling grieving or delivering babies. You know, I said, my goal is to be there to do what I need to do. And I was fortunate to have a leader like Scott who had kind of teed it up for us. There certainly, I think, were episodes of, you know, how do you credential? One of the things at an organizational level we have talked about within our orthopedic societies is how do you credential people to come into an international disaster like that and make sure that they do things that are appropriate? And what are the ethics of that? And that, you know, if the first 48 hours, you know, you're a general practitioner and the patient's going to die of gangrene, well, then you should probably do an amputation. But a week later, if there's four orthopedic surgeons there at that site, then you probably shouldn't be doing it, you know. And so there were, I think, clearly the vast majority of the people that I saw there were operating within that. But you certainly were, you heard of and maybe were aware of, you know, things that were starting to blur those boundaries a little bit. And there's a lot of discussion amongst our orthopedic, you know, medical leadership about how do you address that exact issue.
When you left, were there other orthopedic teams that came to take your place? I mean, what's the ongoing picture now, or has it calmed down to where you don't even have doctors in
place? So the question is, how do you go forward with orthopedic care? The CURE International, the organization that Scott had worked for, was, you know, kind of setting up a pipeline for the first 2 or 3 months. So yes, as we left, there are other people coming, and that has continued. It turns out, to kind of talk about the local politics of that particular hospital, really became untenable for CURE to continue staffing. I mean, they didn't want them there. You know, they were a 70-bed, predominantly primary care OB hospital, and they didn't want a large orthopedic presence. And so they made it difficult. So the CURE has moved across town to a hospital that has been there for a long time, is established by the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and Loma Linda University has a strong connection there. And so, and that program, I'm actually going to have the opportunity to go back in November with CURE and Loma Linda to that program, and have a little follow-up to see. And there is, you know, as you again, and it's obviously something that is interesting to me, and I've read a fair bit of my own, is that this dilemma of how much non-earthquake care do you give, you know, and then how do you, what I think CURE and Loma Linda University and the orthopedists are trying to do is tie that into education and support for the local orthopedist. And so not to just kind of show up and take care of patients, but at least to try to improve the infrastructure a little bit while you're there.
Yeah. Carl, thanks a lot. It was a great presentation. I know that it was an unusual experience. We all appreciate your telling us about it. Tell us, and Carl, by the way, performed miracles every day at the Scottish Rite Hospital. Now, they're the poor, they're the people that have all kinds of things. It wasn't the chaos, but it's the same principle of taking care of people that have nothing, basically, and we all appreciate that, too. I think that America needs a better system of taking care of emergencies. The military is the ideal one, and the Navy has the way. 50 years ago, we went to Africa with the Ship of Hope. Now we support the Mercy Ship with free ships in Africa and Asia. And the value of a ship is you can go there, you have security, you have your own water, you have your operating room. Instead of chaos, you're bringing in an organized event. And I can't understand why we don't use the hospital ship mentality in all of these disasters around the world. You get a ship we really need a carrier, a nuclear carrier that's set up for a hospital rather than the old hospital ship. But what would you say would be the ideal way to approach something like a Haiti and Chile, Seoul, or whatever?
Yeah, and even, you know, I mean, in the past week, Pakistan, you know, I mean, which is so far out of our, you know, realm. I mean, it's interesting that that's probably a greater, in many ways, humanitarian crisis, but we're not inundated with it as we were with Haiti, I'm sure for a lot of interesting cultural reasons. It's, you know, I'm not sure. I mean, I think you need a combination of modalities because ultimately, I think we have a responsibility or opportunity or both to try to raise the water, you know, and the problem with bringing all the patients to you is that you don't have the education of the local population. I mean, you part of that is teaching the local surgeons and the local nurses. It depends on how poor the underlying infrastructure is, and when there's no underlying infrastructure and there's no rule of law, you're not going to make much progress changing culture. And Scott can tell you that just in the 5 years, because that's the ideal of CURE is that you build a hospital that's faith-based and you teach the local medical staff and chaplain staff and hospital administrative staff to run the hospital. And at some point, you turn it over and they don't need Western, you know, first world support any longer. And Scott will tell you that's a long, I mean, there are just so many cultural barriers just to the educational medical staff. I mean, just the way it's just totally foreign to how we are trained and educated, and so I'm not sure there is a right answer, but it's just going to require a lot of effort.
Carl, what about the problem of AIDS? Haiti was known to have a high incidence of AIDS there, and did that factor into, you know, transfusion? I mean, I'm sure if people were just dying, it will just cream the blood to see if they had AIDS, but is that going to factor into the care, ongoing care, and recovery of people?
You know, it's interesting because it's certainly, that's a great question, and what about HIV, which has been historically so high, and hepatitis, HIV, and typhoid are, you know, endemic in Haiti, and so how does that factor into the recovery from the earthquake? I mean, I think it's certainly on the minds of all those who are providing health care. Most of those are somewhat chronic diseases. And so I think that acute problems have to be taken care of, you know, despite that. And then that's, you know, one more thing to add to the list of chronic problems that need to be addressed.
My question is more towards people who are organizations that want to get involved, well-being. And some are probably going to be of assistance, and some maybe a little bit of, I won't say hindrance, but it could slow some things down just by having more people standing around. And just like what you said, if I don't have this, there's really no need for me to be here any longer. You said you're going back in November, and there's probably some takeaways that maybe you got to see. If you decide to get involved in the organization and you do want to go, maybe five things that you could tell people to consider, and maybe if this is not you, that might be another way for you to get involved. So that's
another question. Yeah, that's another really outstanding question. You know, just kind of as a segue into that, Carolyn came up with this idea. encouragement to, you know, go be with your friend and colleague, and then as Friday wore on and that became more and more of a possible reality, kind of the last two calls that I made were to the chief of staff at Scottish Rite and Tony Herring and J.C. Montgomery, who's the president of the hospital, and said, you know, I'm going to do this. And you know, Tony's comment was, you know, make sure that you're useful, you know, and he said, you know, at Katrina there were neurosurgeons taking temperatures. You know, I mean, that's a poor use or utilization. And JC brought up the idea of liability. And said, you know, if you know, to the extent that you individually are organizing this, you know, you need to really make sure that it's within the organization that's organizing it, which I thought was very, you know, sage advice from, you know, great friends and mentors. And as I have reflected on that, and what is it that, you know, draws me to Haiti rather than to our church, which took a group to Ethiopia and took a group to Kenya. And I've given that a lot of thought this summer. And it, I think, is the fact that I have a very known quantity on the ground. You know, and my trip in November, I was at a meeting in July and Scott was there. And, you know, he kind of spoke and I said, is there still a need? And he said, yes. I said, should I come back? And he said, absolutely. And so he, you know, I know that there's inside on the ground knowledge that there will be things that need my unique skill set. And I think it certainly is a much greater leap of faith to go to be involved at some level for whatever your skill set is without that. And so I guess I don't have a 5-point checklist, but I think, you know, as much diligence as you can do to talk to either the people who are there or the people who have been there to figure out, you know, what's it like? What do you do? I mean, what do they need? And is that, can I do that? And am I interested in doing that? And, you know, one of the things that came out of the Orthopedic National Meeting, they called them SUVs, which were single unaffiliated volunteers. And they universally had bad experiences when you talk to them, you know. And when you talk to the people who were not SUVs, the SUVs were in the way, you know. I mean, so the people who showed up, you know, kind of well-intended, and I'm just, boy, I have to be there, and that was the extent of their planning, it wasn't good for them or for anyone else. And so I think probably like anything in life, the more diligence you do ahead of time and the more it's planned out and programmed, the better it's going to be for all the parties.
And we actually had a question on which organizations you would recommend people become involved with. I know you talked about how you estimate about 2,000 to 4,000 amputees on the ground. Is there an organization providing prosthetics or a group that you would recommend people get involved in? And while he answers that, I'm going to put a slide up that our staff researched, basically organizations that were endorsed by the State Department to give to, whether by text or online. So while you answer that, I'm just going to pop this slide up.
Sure. I again, my experience has really been very, very personal, led through Scott. And it's interesting, as I have tried to kind of make those connections and figure out how to have an ongoing relationship, we all have a different skill set. And Scott's real skill set is he wants to be there and he wants to take care of patients. And he doesn't want to necessarily help rebuild the empire. And so he's been a great resource for being there on the ground and helping, but it's not been a great resource for trying to reach out and find other things. There is an organization, and the name is escaping me now, that is partnering with both the National Prosthetic Organization and the National Orthopedic Organization. The prosthetists have a fairly well, thought out plan to address it. But yet, again, then when you talk to the people on the ground, the labs and the training that needs to go on is not yet happening. So hopefully I'll have a better answer in November.
Well, let us know when you get back. And this is just what the State Department recommended. It's there's the Clinton Bush Foundation, the Clinton Bush Haiti Fund, and the American Red Cross. So those were endorsed by the State Department, so I thought you might want to check those out. Are there any other questions? Go ahead.
And thanks for your kind remarks. And I, I feel like such a small part of this, and I feel like I have such little knowledge. And obviously your experience, I think, is really what's needed to solve the problem. And like you said, in the first month there were acute needs, but now there's a chronic need, and it needs to be people with your expertise and not my expertise. It's called SHOT, the Society Haitian Orthopedic and Traumatology, which is the national Haitian orthopedic organization with the 46 members. So both of our pediatric orthopedic group and our general national orthopedic group are partnering with SHOT to there's a task force of a relatively small 3 or 4 people who were just there last month. And one of the things that they have come up with is that people who are going to go need to incorporate the local orthopedist and need to compensate the local orthopedist. And I think, you're nodding in agreement. So I think something along that lines is absolutely necessary, because otherwise it's they're never going to pull themselves up. And I'd be very interested in knowing. One of the sense that I have is that they say 1 in 8 Haitians lives abroad. And one of the things that I heard is, one of the cultural problems they have is most of the people, with get up and go, got up and went, and so there's this huge exodus of their, talent. And so what's left is not. And it's just a tough problem.
There are some that are,
yeah. Yeah, clearly, yeah.
Very
And probably we need to reset our Western time frame too. I mean, you know, we would like it to be fixed in this quarter or next quarter, you know, and it's probably not going to happen that quickly. Yeah.
Well, it looks like we're about ready to wrap up, and if you don't mind staying for just a couple more informal questions, if anybody has anything else to ask Dr. Rastin. I'd like to thank all of you for being here today, and Pat, thank you again for another amazing program recommendation. You have never steered us wrong, so thank you. And thank you, Dr. Rastin. We really appreciate your being here and for your service. Thank you.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.